Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is an interior paint and primer in one with a tough-lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Coming up on this week's show, bad news for Wii Homebrew fans.
A new Spectrum magazine launches.
And we chat about the culture of the demo scene with Tobias Kopka.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every Friday with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, recently on the show, we've been talking about unreleased games over the last few weeks. And there is a book that they released recently called The Games That Weren't, that is in stock right now on their website, covering more than 40 years of video games that sadly never saw the light of day for a variety of reasons. And this book actually shines a light on those. Now, loads of legendary titles in here, dating from 1975 right up to the PlayStation 4, including screenshots of stories of what happened as well, and interviews with the authors of these games that never made it to market. Weighing in at 644 pages, you can check it out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCB Way. Now, PCB Way, massive supporters of the retro community, and they offer fully featured custom PCB prototyping, low cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and if you're looking for services like 3D printing and injection molding, they've got you covered. And also check out the shared project section on their website to see what people are doing in the retro community with PCB Way, and get an instant quote right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 478, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbotts.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to this week's show, the podcast that comes out every single Friday and celebrates all the wonderfulness about the world of retro gaming and technology. We bring you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro from over the last week, and I think definitely a highlight of this podcast. Second half of the show, when we welcome on industry veterans for an interview in part two. Now, this is something that we've done, almost 500 interviews. We've covered so many different topics on this podcast. But today, we're going to be delving into the world of the demo scene. Now, it is actually quite fitting that we're talking about the demo scene this week. I know over Easter, actually, the Easter weekend, there was a massive demo party. This is where basically people that are really into the demo scene all get together physically in a massive hall, show off the latest productions, music demos, art discs, lots more. We'll get into all that. But there's a huge one called Revision that was on over the Easter weekend. And I was actually checking out a few of the productions that were released at Revision this weekend. And it's just incredible, the creativity and how far people are still pushing this old hardware. Because you might have been like me, Ravi. I mean, we didn't attend any demo scene events back in the 90s. Slightly too young and a bit too poor to travel to all of these.
Yeah, we weren't cool enough, Dan, to get
there. Yeah, I'll be honest. We'd have got laughed out of the place, let's be honest. I think that they call them lamers. We would probably be considered. But yeah, it's incredible because the demo scene now just feels like it's stronger than ever.
Yeah, it's great because it's kind of driven by creativity. You know, people are coding, they're making magazines, they're doing all sorts. And, you know, there's a lot of limited space, people create amazing things with it, but also it's not platform specific as well. Ooh. So, you know, demos, we've seen some great ones even on the Mega Drive and stuff. And we see demos all over the place. There's even been demos from space, which is pretty amazing to see. And this week, you know, we've got a guest that we previously had on in 2020. So a lot's changed since then. And that was Tobias Kotka. And he's Melkor of How Job as well, the demo group. But also, you know, he helped with the Art of Coding initiative, being the co-initiator of it. And we talk about, you know, the cultural importance of the demo scene and how it's internationally recognized now. But also, like, things that have changed in there, you know, how it's grown over time. His history as well with the demo scene.
But you're right, I think that's something really incredible that him and his team are doing with UNESCO. Now, UNESCO are the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. And they're an agency of the United Nations with the aim of promoting education, arts, sciences and culture. And like most of the best ideas, we'll get into this in the interview, it came up on a night out, didn't it? Him and a few of his friends had a couple of drinks, and they thought, wouldn't it be amazing if we can get the demo scene officially recognised as a cultural, artistic phenomenon with UNESCO? And they've gone and done it in several countries.
Yeah, it's like alongside stuff like Stonehenge. And, yeah. You know, I think it's great that, you know, you've got digital culture that's actually now celebrated and recognized as well, because demo scene's fantastic. We've always loved it because we've been totally into that, but in the mainstream and stuff, it's not that well known about, and it may have been like sidelined by people. But we talk about how it's kind of helped, you know, people even running demo events going, oh yes, it's UNESCO recognized, and then people suddenly go, oh okay, you can use our big hall and you know, have a big party. And it's really interesting, and all the different countries that have been involved in it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I've got a feeling it might be a little bit easier now for them to get those halls hired out, because I've seen videos of the gathering and stuff, you know, these big demo parties that were on in the 90s that were like 2,000, like, 16-year-olds crammed together in a room.
You wanted to be there, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. That's the thing is, like, if I'd have had the money, and like, I couldn't really say to my mum, look, you know, I didn't have any friends that were into this stuff, really.
I'm taking my monitor and my...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm just getting a flight up to Germany on my own, when I'm 14 years old. That was never going to happen. So I used to kind of read about them in like Dismags, like Grapevine, that were on the Amiga back then. But also the fact that that changed a lot in the 90s when the PC came along. And how you define kind of platforms, because, you know, PCs had sound cards and graphic cards that you could upgrade. So we talk about that a lot more as well with Tobias. So if you've ever been curious about the demo scene, we go into a lot of its kind of origins and kind of where it's at today as well, and the cultural importance of it, with this week's special guest, Tobias Kotka. He's coming up on the show in around half an hour from now. But of course, you know the way the podcast works. If you're a regular, first half of it is when we talk about the big news stories that have been landing on our timelines over the last week. And this one is a bit of sad news. And I imagine, particularly for you, Ravi, being our resident Wii hacker, anyone that knows that's got a Wii or a Wii U, Ravi's always straight there to offer, well, I'll hack it for you. But this is the Nintendo Wii homebrew community, the homebrew channel, has now ceased development. Now, for people that might not be familiar with what the homebrew channel does, what is it, Ravi?
The homebrew channel is basically the home of the kind of applications that you install in there. So once you've kind of modded your Wii, then you'd install the homebrew channel on there, and that would be the place that you can have like all your emulators, you can have all your different apps that have been created for it, and they're not the official, you know, Nintendo apps. The kind of hacked versions. There's like different tools for loading up stuff, connecting your Wii. There's tons of like different devices for it. I had a few emulators in there, and then it's like the background of the homebrewing on the Wii, and you can do some fabulous stuff. And the Wii version is massively developed as well, because it's been around for a long time. And the Wii was actually quite easy to hack and, you know, break, and then load this kind of non-signed code onto it.
Mm. Was this when, because Nintendo, they closed down their official Wii support on the channel, so this kind of took over from that?
Well, you wouldn't be able to put in the Wii stuff. So it's just kind of like your menu for loading stuff up and being able to put applications in. I don't know if there is another alternate way doing it without the Homebrew channel. There might be, but Homebrew channel is the easiest. You can also get like updated applications for it. It's a bit like Steam, but for the kind of Homebrew stuff, you know. You can get updates on there and just download stuff that is linked to it kind of directly.
Well, it seems like a cool tool. Don't know about you, Joe. I've not used it before, but it turns out we might not get much of a chance in future.
I was going to say, you think this is something I've used?
I haven't either. You're not alone. But yeah, well, there's a bit of controversy around it now.
I don't want to put my foot in my mouth here. So what this article is saying is one of the key figures behind the Homebrew channel is in trouble with Nintendo because apparently they stole code from Nintendo to get this working. And I'm just a little bit like, okay, isn't that obvious that that's what they would have done? Like, because of it's essentially, it's pirated, hacked software. Yeah. Like, so I don't really understand why this is like controversial, because surely we all knew, everybody using this would have known that it was like stolen code, or have I misunderstood this?
So officially it's not used to load up all your games. You know, those are the plugins and stuff. It's a bit like Kodi, when you had Kodi, you know, that wasn't illegal because it was just a front end for loading up stuff. If you put dodgy stuff on it, then you were doing kind of dodginess. It's meant to, you know, just be a way of loading unsigned applications. So if you went on it and kind of put on a program for doing draw and doing some artwork on your Wii, you could do that and you wouldn't be breaking any copyright or anything like that. But what seems to have happened is not Nintendo, but a developer within the community. It seems that they've said that some of the code has been stolen from the Nintendo software development kit that came out, so some official code, but also some code has been taken off from this operating system, Artems, which is an open source one. And they said they've taken out all the kind of information on there. And I think
all the attributions are gone, yeah. Yeah, so it's not credited,
And I think the thing is, Homebrew Channel probably wanted to go out as a legit thing, you know, so it can be established. It's been there for so long. And I think this has caused a lot of the kind of issues within the community, saying it was, you know, built on top of lies and copyright infringement, which is, you know, everyone's in fear of Nintendo with this kind of thing. So having that out there, you know, but it also seems it's kind of been outed from within the development community. It's a tough thing because, you know, some people will just see it as a hacker thing as well. But if it's totally legal and legitimate, then, you know, there's not much Nintendo could say. They say, you know, you've accessed it using an exploit, but it's still legitimate and clear.
Yeah. So basically it's developers of the hacking group Fail Overflow. And there's this library in there called LiboGC library, and they found out that there is a lot of code that's taken from Nintendo's proprietary SDK, and as you mentioned, Ravi, from the open source Artems project without any attribution. And apparently they suspected this for a while, but then now they found about the Artems code that's in there as well. They basically said that, you know, that, as you said, they've criticized it and said that it's not something that should be further developed due to the possibility of legal implications. Now, the thing is, this has been around. I mean, if Nintendo cared, they probably would have maybe looked into this, you know, already.
And yeah, found they're not going to spend their time pumping out an update to stop the exploits happening. But what I think will probably happen is, it seems like it's a bit of an internal fight to me, this. What will probably happen is there'll be another method of doing it without the store, or it will be forked and there might be some reverse engineering or something that will happen that will, you know, change it. It's a pity to see it go because it's really nice. But I think it's not been removed off machines. I think it's just been removed off GitHub. I could be totally wrong with all of these details, but just reading it off what's out there at the moment.
No, you're right. Yeah. So basically the GitHub's been turned to read only. So it means that there's not going to be any future updates or support of it. And they're saying it kind of casts a shadow over the broader kind of Wii homebrew scene. And also, I mean, kind of other projects as well that are built on similar foundations, you know, that could raise some concerns about their legality and the integrity of them as well. So it is kind of have, you know, wider reaching implications, I think. But I also see what you said, Joe, as well, that really a lot of the times people are installing this to run pirated games anyway.
Yeah.
So the morality of it's a bit kind of like, you know what I mean? It's a
strange situation.
It is. But yes, I mean, as you said, Ravi, hopefully this will be something that they can maybe, you know, maybe there's some talented developers in the scene who can kind of rewrite those bits of the code and get this up and running again, I'm sure. So, yeah, sad state, though, if you're into the Wii homebrew scene at the moment. Looks like there's a bit of drama going on there, so I'm going to read more about that. I'll link that in this week's show notes. Now, I think this looks really cool. Not often that we talk about Master System games. But it does feel like, you know, there's a few of them kind of bubbling under that maybe we should turn our attention to, because this one looks really
impressive.
I love
the way you say it, Dan. Very posh. Master System.
The Sega Master System. Master How do you say system. It?
Master.
Master and the Master System. Well, this is a new game for the beloved 8-bit Sega machine called Frontier Force. Love the graphics on this.
Sorry, I'm trying to get over Master System.
One of us has to talk properly on this show.
I was hoping when you said how would you say it, Ravi, you'd be like, right, blimey, Governor, it's the Master System. we don't seem to talk about the Master System that much because of mostly, you know, kind of like what I tend to see, at least anyway, whenever I see these kind of like homebrews or new games, it's usually Mega Drive games or Game Boy games, you know, there's been a huge thing of Game Boy or Dreamcast and stuff. So the Master System, you know, never seem to see these new games coming out on it. I could just be in the wrong places on the internet, but this one caught my eye. Like you say, Frontier Force. And the reason it caught my eye is you're spot on there, Dan. The graphics on this, absolutely stunning. So this is being developed by Bad Computer, who have made some other games which I haven't heard of, so I'm going to check these out, called Star Runner and Blast Arena. Which are their more prolific kind of examples of games they've done. They've done quite a few by the sounds of things. But straight away, the look of this game, and bearing in mind it's a Master System game, graphically it reminded me of Space Harrier.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Even down to the character with his laser gun there. So to describe the game, it's a shoot. It looks like a shoot 'em up, but you're at the bottom of the screen, running side to side, shooting like an energy weapon, which reminds me of the Super Nintendo game Super Buster Bros. And then enemies kind of come at you, and you know, and it's set in the kind of like neon future, you know, very much kind of like those 80s and 90s games, hence like Space Harrier and maybe like Arrow Flash and stuff like that it reminds me of. But graphically, the colours on this look absolutely fantastic, and the gameplay looks awesome from what they have shown so far. And if one of you guys put this in the news and just said, yeah, it's a Mega Drive game, I wouldn't have doubted you.
Yeah.
I think it looks absolutely stunning.
I love the way that the weapons seem so overpowered as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's proper blasting from the bottom of the screen to the top. Yeah. It's like, yeah. And I love shooting up games anyway. I've never been that good at them. You know, I can get by with a bit of Gallagher maybe, but when they got a bit beyond that, I'm kind of crap at them, but I enjoy them. But yeah, I haven't played many kind of Sega Master System games recently. I've got, you know, obviously the Mega Drive can run them, so I can via my EverDrive.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think this will be the first one that I bought, because I'm definitely going to get hold of this. So if you want to get hold of this, you can get it from their itch page. And there's five stages to play through. There's two bonus stages that are hidden as well. You've got to discover. There's boss fights in there as well, some massive end stage enemies. It's got a soundtrack from music composer Crisp. It was very well known on the Sega scene. Loaded different weapons. You can toggle between using the D-pad as well. So, yeah, in terms of kind of retro-looking shoot-em-up games, this looks really good. Six different weapons on it as well.
It's coming out in a physical version as well in 2 weeks from when we're recording this. And the box just looks absolutely fantastic. And that's $50 for the cartridge, box and manual as well. So, yeah, fantastic to see, you know, a physical Master System release as well.
Yeah, I love a good Master System game.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not a Nottingham native.
And it also works with the adapter as well.
Yeah, and there's a ROM file you can download as well if you just want to play it on your EverDrive. So, yeah, it looks awesome. So, yeah, I mean, for the sake of $4.99, I think this is a no-brainer. So if you want a good retro shoot-em-up to play over the summer, definitely worth looking out for. Something else as well that is on itch.io right now. This one's actually free. It is a brand new ZX Spectrum magazine that I saw someone alerted us to on our Discord. I do apologize. I didn't write down who it was. But I mean, the thing is, we all often talk about paper magazines on the podcast. But I do like a good digital one that I can read on my iPad as well when there's stuff like this, you know, that is free that comes along. I've been reading, there's one on the Amiga called What If or What IFF.
Yes, yeah. That one's really interesting. And it's good to see this. You know, they've packed a lot in this.
Yeah.
They've got 33 reviews, which is, wow, quite a lot for issue number one as well. And I love that, you know, they've made it public and free. The PDF to come out as well. It looks like there's a lot of passion in this. A lot of text as well. There's, you know, a lot of reading, which is pretty awesome. And I guess it's quite good with the Spectrum Next out there because you've got a growing user base as well. And then, you know, you've got your traditional titles as well. I always love the Spectrum. It's got definitely a good charm.
Well, this is a new digital-only magazine called Breakspace. They describe it as the economy magazine for ZX Spectrum enthusiasts. Issue 1 is available now for download. What's cool is you also do a version that's optimized for phones as well. So there's like a phone-friendly version, which makes it a lot easier than kind of zooming and pinching and zooming a PDF. I kind of love the humor in this as well. Like even straight there on the front cover, it says over 33 reviews, but less than 35. Yeah. So I mean, there's a lot of humor and like kind of tongue-in-cheekness goes through this magazine. But they really focus on the modern Spectrum scene. And even reading the introduction editorial, they're talking about, you know, why release a new Spectrum magazine now. They said, well, in 2024, there were 160 games released for the ZX Spectrum.
Bonkers, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no stopping you stealing a photocopier from work and printing this PDF out as well, which might be another way to view it.
Yeah, I mean, it looks great. I mean, it's got, again, load of great screenshots in there. As you mentioned, a lot of text. Looks like it's quite a big team working on this. About, five guys currently working on this. Five Star, they call themselves. Some really funny commentary and images. And kind of reminds me a lot of the kind of the classic Specky Mags back in the day. But I think, it's just awesome to see something new coming out like this that's dedicated to a retro platform. And I think, it would be cool if they are covering kind of Spectrum Next releases and focusing on the new Spectrum scene, which is really cool. So it's very cool to see someone putting a highlight on the Spectrum scene right now. And it's quite long as well, 30 pages and completely free. So looks like they're going to be releasing these four times a year at the moment, it looks like. So obviously bin issue one, give it a download and give them your feedback, you know, show them some appreciation. It'd be great to see this continuing. That's called Breakspace. I'll put a link to get that in this week's show notes. Now, last week on the show, we were talking about that new Outrun movie that apparently is in development with Michael Bay at the helm. This one, though, might have even more mainstream appeal. And apparently, some of the guys involved in the Sonic the Hedgehog movie, the company who worked on that called Story Kitchen, are involved in this as well. They're apparently going to be doing a live-action Toys R Us film.
In a world where Jeffrey the Giraffe is played by Arnold Schwarzenegger. Come on, guys. We need to get to the toy shop now.
I thought you were going to start singing the Toys R Us theme tune. There's a magical place.
I'm not going to sing it. Yeah, so apparently a Toys R Us movie is in development, which is aiming to kind of catch the magic of the 80s and 90s and how it was a magical place for children in the 80s and 90s. And it was like, there was a massive Toys R Us near where I grew up. And I think we used to go like once a year, you know, near my birthday, surprisingly, you know, you kind of like hated it. Everything.
You hate it.
Oh, of course you do. What do you like, Ravi? Come on.
It was a tin shack full of stuff I couldn't afford. You'd go in there, you'd buy your rubbish small toy that you could get that you were promised, and then you'd walk through aisles of stuff that you wanted.
That's when the depression started.
I often read, particularly from like American Toys R Us fans back in the day, that, you know, really big for computers and video games. I was trying to think if I ever remember seeing cons. I've got a feeling I might. Again, this is something that in my mind I remember seeing, like a Commodore 64C and like an Amiga maybe set up in Toys R Us. But then I don't know if that's something I've seen on a YouTube video and kind of imagine that I saw it.
We went to Toys R Us and bought Mega Drive games.
Yeah.
I do remember getting Power Rangers for the Mega Drive for my birthday from Toys R Us. And then I remember when I was an early teenager going into Toys R Us, and I didn't have a PS2, but my brother did. And he'd moved out by this point. And my mum went in, took me in, and she was like, right, I want you to pick out some PS2 games. And I was like, like, kind of thing, thinking I was getting a PS2. And she was like, I want you to pick out some games. And she was like, for your brother, for his birthday. Oh, and I was like, oh, okay. Because me and mine and my brother's birthdays are only a couple of weeks apart.
Actually, there was one thing that I did appreciate, which was their selection of Super Soakers and Nerf guns. That was
there you go.
That was quite good. But it did seem very American when it we had it in the UK. Right. I don't know if the American stores were prettier than ours. Than the tin kind of sheds that we got. Maybe they were more like prominent in the malls or places like that.
They had kind of like both. They had the smaller shops in malls and stuff, and then they also had the huge warehouses like what they were in the UK. But yeah, they're not said much about this development of the film of it, just other than, you know, it's being brought to you by this company, Story Kitchen, that have been involved with, you know, usually with transferring video game IPs. To movies. And obviously Toys R Us, I guess, is not a million miles away from video games. And obviously there's been video game movies have been a lot more successful in the last kind of 5-6 years. I just don't know where they're going to go with it, with the story. Like, are they going to go super kiddie and it's going to be about Jeffrey the Giraffe, or is it going to be like real people? Do you know what I mean? Like, and it's going to be about a Toys R Us shop or something.
Apparently there's going to be live action, which to me would suggest real actors, not like a, you know, not a film like Sonic the Hedgehog that's like animated, for example. Or
yeah, but they say that's live action. They said the Lion King remake was live action when there's nothing real in it.
Well, there is a quote here from a president of Story Kitchen, Kim Miller-Olko, who says, it will be a journey as boundless as play itself, evoking the electric sense of wonder that is the essence of Toys R Us. And this story will capture the imagination, adventure and joy that's made Toys R Us a destination for kids of all ages. So basically saying nothing at all.
I'm going to wait for Woolworths, the movie.
Yeah.
Now that.
Which could be an interesting documentary, actually, couldn't it? Yeah, about those failed brands. But there's an article here on Retro Dodo, and they say for what the film might look like. Apparently it's been compared to something like Night at the Museum.
Okay.
Or even other blockbusters like Jumanji and Back to the Future, which, sounds slightly bizarre. I mean, I suppose you could have something like Toys R Us in a time travel movie.
And then they have to get rights for every single toy that they show in there. So, that would be interesting.
Seems an interesting time as well, but I keep reading Toys R Us is coming back, and then didn't it come back in WH Smith, which is now closing down everywhere? So are they around anymore? Point. It's like, seems a bizarre time to...
That'll be the end of the movie. The toys in the corner of W.H. Smith, like, no, the door's closing.
So, but I mean, you made a good point there, Joe, the fact that they've done a lot of these kind of video game movies recently kind of looks like maybe they're treading the toes into seeing if more general nostalgia would work for people that are not video games fans.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, actually, you know. Yeah. General nostalgia movies, which will probably work on idiots like me. I was about to say, so I'm excited to see it. Excited is a strong word. I'm curious to see what the premise of the film would be, but it feels like, I don't know, I want to say scraping the bottom of the barrel a little. I don't know, like, there's so many other IPs it could pick, like for films and stuff as well, for video game movies and stuff before they go for the likes of like Outrun, you know, for example, and now Toys R Us. But I don't know, I guess, is it, maybe it's Toys R Us as a company, as an entity, who are like, trying to get a movie off the ground.
Yeah, like I said, if they're closing all the shops down again, then it might be like, well, we need to do something with the brand to get some money in. But I think if you're talking about people about our age, I mean, you couldn't think of it, many brands that were bigger in our childhood than Toys R Us generally, and for people that are not video game fans, for example. I think it's got quite broad appeal, particularly in America as well. It kind of works both sides of the pond. So,
yeah, definitely.
Interesting to see what they do with it. Could be good, could be absolutely awful, but we'll keep an eye on that as the story develops. Now, speaking of movies at the moment, obviously the number one movie at the cinema right now is the Minecraft movie. Any of you boys been to see it or interested?
I've never played Minecraft in my life.
Really?
I played the beta version. I was well into Minecraft when it started.
He was there, man.
I was there in the beginning.
Before it was cool.
Yeah. And
I've not got anything against Minecraft, by the way. Like, that's not me being like, oh, it looks terrible, I've never played it. It's just, I don't know, it's just never happened, really. Mm. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, that kind of game doesn't appeal to me or anything like that. It's just, I've just never picked it up. I've just never gone, oh, I'm going to play Minecraft or anything like that. Maybe it's a subconscious thing, because the first time I ever heard of Minecraft was my mother-in-law used to play it.
Right.
When it was brand new. So maybe I was just like, oh, I don't want to play that.
In case you bump into her in the virtual world.
Yeah, maybe.
But I mean, in terms of, you know, longevity, I mean, yeah, you mentioned about the beta there, Ravi. That came out in 2009.
Yeah.
So it's a 16-year-old game, still going bigger than ever now, actually.
And a genius idea as well.
Yeah. Lego, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, but also it's like a completely generated world that's random every time that you could craft to your own kind of way. It's a great idea. And, you know, it's grown into something huge, but even in those really basic days, it was still a good concept. And we're talking about a really basic version of it at the moment, a demake, actually.
Now, this is on the Pico 8 platform, which is, it's kind of like a game engine, isn't it? A virtual machine.
It's like a fantasy console that was developed based on kind of 8-bit systems, but with a limitation. So it's a 16-color display. And 128 by 128 pixel. It had a quite a good programming language as well. So, you know, a lot of people, I think we've seen some Doom clones in there, you know, that a lot of people have coded, but this is very like our kind of demo scene chat today, where we talk about technical limitations and people being able to push that really far. You know, Pico 8 is a great example of that, you know, people being able to push this tiny little system and this tiny little display to do some amazing things.
Yeah, no, it's essentially it's a virtual machine, isn't it? And like you said, the idea is it kind of mimics the limited graphics and sound that the old 8-bit systems had. And you can run this on loads of different platforms. There's actually kind of virtual machines that you can download and run on Windows, Mac OS, Linux as well. There's also people who've kind of made it into hardware. There's images for like the Raspberry Pi and the pocket chip
and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can even play them in RetroArch and stuff like that as well. So it's an interesting platform. But this is someone who's made a Minecraft demake for the Pico 8 called Linecraft. And you can actually play this in browser if you want to get a look at it on their itch page.
It works really well. Like the basic functions are there. You know, the way that they've done it as well, they're kind of shaded the graphics really, really small, but they've also got like animations in there. They've got crafting in there. And I like the fact that you can share your worlds as well, because that was another big thing with Minecraft. You'd see the world and then you'd be able to share that, and other people would be able to get the kind of same world. It looks fun. I think it's amazing what they can kind of fit into these small things.
Now, this is called Linecraft because originally it was wireframe graphics, but they've actually managed to put some like polygon renders in there with static patterns on the blocks instead of textures. Obviously, there's not much RAM on this. And every world in the game is a 64 by 64 map, and you can mine blocks in there. You can make houses. You can do a lot that you would do in there. You can play it in the different modes, creative survival mode as well, just like in real Minecraft. As you mentioned there's a world exporting and importing, so you can share your worlds to different users, isometric screenshots as well. And apparently, there's a tutorial here about porting the worlds from it actually to Minecraft itself, which is quite cool. And it's also mobile friendly. I think it looks awesome though. I mean, I've only played the demo for a couple of minutes, but I think in terms of the physics of it and the movement, it feels very fluid. It does actually feel like playing Minecraft, because Minecraft's weird. You look at it. I remember when it first came out thinking, that looks like really rudimentary. And then trying to run it on my, I think I was running Windows Vista or something.
It was originally on Java. Yeah,
yeah, it was. I remember it lagging on my PC at the time, and I thought, hang on a minute, this game looks really basic. But actually, I remember it being reasonably demanding, actually.
You know, when I played the modern version, it was really smooth, and I kind of felt a bit sick. So I was like, bring back the lag, because I was used to the kind of laggy version. And I was like, oh, God, this is too smooth.
I remember people playing it on like Power Max and stuff. Like I said, it's Java, isn't it?
So yeah, yeah. So there's been builds for it, for everything.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, this looks really cool. So if you want something that's obviously, as we mentioned, limitations can breed creativity. And if you have got maybe a Pico 8 kind of hardware device as well, something very cool to play. It looks like a very fully featured game. So there are versions available to run either standalone or there's a Raspberry Pi, Mac OS, Linux, and Windows zip file that you can download as well, completely free on the itch.io page, which I'll link up in this week's show notes. So, of course, you want to check that out, and along with all the other stories, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week. Check out your podcast app, or you can head to the website for the notes at theretrohour.com. Now, we did have a wonderful patrons hangout this weekend just gone. Nicely, a few new faces in the hangout as well. It's always nice to welcome new people.
Yeah, it was really good. Big shout out to Ellie and Mike. Great to see, people showing their collection and stuff. We had a really good chat. It's great as well because, you know, we get regulars, but we get people from all over the world. And, it was quite interesting because two people from the same area as well were like, oh, do you go to this event and stuff? And it's nice to kind of link up people as well. It's a really good community, the patrons.
We talk about all kinds of stuff as well. For some reason, we got into like Beavis and Butthead chat.
I remember because you bought a load of VHSs and you were showing off.
I was showing off my videotapes. I used to have all the Beavis and Butthead VHS tapes. Got rid of them all about 3 or 4 years ago. Bought them all back again off eBay in Dutch. It turned out when I got the tapes, didn't realise at the time. Only subtitles though. So that's the thing. We got into a whole discussion about it, and it was just so much fun, the patrons hangouts that we do. Now, we do these end of every month normally. It's their last Sunday of the month when we generally tend to do them. And all patrons are welcome. Basically a massive Zoom call where we all geek out for a couple of hours. So if you'd like to join our next one, our wonderful patrons community, all the details are at theretrohour.com. You get invited to a special area of our Discord as well. We're chatting away all throughout the week. You get the normal podcast ad-free, sometimes early if I can get it out. And also, you can join our public beta if you want to see the video version of this podcast. You can see our lovely faces on camera.
It's going well, actually. I mean, I'm enjoying doing the video version. We're gonna do the news soon as well, which should be interesting.
So if you'd like to give us a bit of feedback as we hopefully roll that out to everybody before long. But if you want to join our patrons community, all the details are at theretrohour.com to help us keep the lights on and make sure this podcast comes out each and every week. Right, patrons, stand by. We have got some news stories on the way for you, because we do that for our patrons, give you an extra 2 or 3 news stories every single week because we chop all the ads out. And for everybody else, can we just take a quick moment to give a massive thank you to a regular supporter, a huge supporter of this podcast, and that is our friends at, you know them by now, it's our mates at Shopify. Now, Shopify is the commerce platform being used by millions of businesses all around the world. Even some of the biggest household names you can think of, Mattel, Gymshark are on there as well, to brands that are just getting started. And the thing is, I mean, so many people these days are setting up their own businesses or side hustles. Figuring it all out yourself can be a little bit overwhelming, to say the least. I mean, we often have nightmares about the days when we were setting up commerce platforms ourselves using like WordPress plugins and stuff back in the day.
Yeah. Oh, God. I won't mention any rivals' names, but it was really tough. And updating them and also kind of, trying to provide customer service with people. But with Shopify, it's 24 hours, which is just absolutely fantastic.
And it's really easy as well. Now, if you haven't used Shopify before, you basically get your own design studio and you click onto it and there's hundreds of ready-to-use templates. So literally you can build a beautiful store that will match your brand style. You can customize the colors and the fonts as well. Click of a mouse. I mean, we've been selling our books on there. Ravi made that in his lunch break. Really easy. So it's full of tools as well. There's even AI in there, like everything these days. But it's really powerful. It helps you write product descriptions, the headlines, even enhance your product photography as well. And it's almost like having a marketing team behind you too, because it can help you easily create email and social media campaigns and get you out to all the social media marketplaces where your customers are scrolling and shopping as well. It's almost like having a commerce expert with you, somebody who's got world-class expertise with everything from managing inventory to international shipping, processing returns and beyond as well. It takes care of all of that for you, so you can focus on what you really want to do, which is run your business. So if you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. Now, of course, we have got you an amazing offer if you want to turn your big business idea into money, into this with Shopify by your side. Use our link, shopify.co.uk/retrohour, and you can sign up for a $1 or £1 a month trial. So if you're based in the US, $1, based in the UK, you'll get it for £1, and you can basically try it out. It's a no-brainer for that price. So head to shopify.co.uk/retrohour, use our link so they know that we sent you, helps out the podcast as well, and get ready to take your business to the next level today, thanks to our friends at Shopify. All right, well, thank you for checking out the news this week. I'll have more for you, of course, on next Friday's podcast. And next, going inside the world and the culture of the demo scene with this week's special guest, Tobias Kopka. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
You won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst, so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. Initial Quality Study Award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a 1-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with Tobias Kopka. And Tobias is amazing. He's been in the demo scene for a long, long time, but he's also helped with the Art of Coding initiative, which is a huge thing, you know, getting UNESCO to recognize the demo scene. And we're going to talk about what the demo scene is, demo parties, but also, you know, games developer events that have happened, and kind of pushing that European gaming side of things. It's going to be really interesting conversation. How are you doing, Tobias?
Oh, I'm fantastic. I just come back from conferences /vacation, so I'm really good. Thank you.
Yeah, great to have you on, because this is the second time you've come on the podcast. So you were on our How Job episode as well, because you're Melkor in that.
Yeah, and it feels like ages ago. I think it was sometime in the pandemic, so episode 280, and you're now in the 400s.
Nearly 500 now.
Yeah, 500, so. Wow. So when listening to it again, I felt like it's, I don't know how it's for you, but speaking while the pandemic, it was so much, I mean, again, it's so much uncertainty right now, but it's a different uncertainty.
Yeah.
And I think everybody was thinking about the past of our digital history, etc., with this uncertainty, can we do that again? And now we know we can do it.
Yes, and it's all coming back. I was wondering, let's start from the beginning then. What was the very first system that you owned?
Owned. Owned was C64 Commodore. Played at was, I think, +4. So yeah, I'm from Germany, so it was not that much consoles for a long while until I think PS1. Mm. So it was really home computer. So C64 and Amiga especially, like my main beloved system.
And I'm interested as well about your discovery of the demo scene. And we have a lot of listeners who might not be too familiar with what the demo scene is. So let's say someone who's got no knowledge, explain kind of what the demo scene is for someone who might not have heard of it before or seen a demo.
Yeah, nowadays the demo scene is a community of people who enjoy creating procedural self-made art with computers, which means it's actually a community of people who gather every few weeks or months for a full weekend to share their recent crafted graphics, music, and so-called demos. And the demos are then artworks of music, sound, visuals, effects, etc., all put in one software, which plays in real time and creates, you can imagine, like kind of a music video just out of software. And the demo scene is centering around these demos. It started in the cracker scene on C64. So actually, it started with people cracking computer games and then putting their name in front of it. So it means I cracked the game first, so I put, let's say, Bomberman was the first, or Super Dude 1000 put then his name in front of a cracked game and wanted to show he was the first, or yeah, oftentimes it was a he who wanted to show he was the first, and then the second said, okay, I can crack a game too, but I put my name in front of it and let the name spin. And then the third said, okay, I can make it spin, but I can make it bounce. And so this led to kind of over years and decades to a competition where people competed more and more and more and creating always more crazy effects in front of crack games.
It was definitely about pushing the boundaries as well, wasn't it? And showing what they could do. Because, I mean, you remember when they were doing this on the Commodore 64 and the Amiga, they were squeezing this into the code before the game on the disc.
Exactly. And that was, you know how it is with artists. I mean, you can say, you can tell people, write anything you want. And it's the biggest block you can give to people. If you can say, you can write anything you want on this one page, just with 40 characters, and they have to be in Gothic or in Comic Sans and have to be whatever, in a form of a syllabus. That pushes the boundaries for people actually to get creative. And that was the same with the boot block in front of a game. There was so little space to put your name and the spinning name and etc., the effects in front of it, that it was really, really a challenge to do always more and more and more amazing things and compete with each other. And so this limitation pushed actually the creativity.
Do you think the competitive nature of cracking a game as well kind of eventually morphed into the competitive nature of creating art against each other, but it kind of drove it and it had that push, you know?
Yes, 100%, especially the personality types it attracted. So in the scene, I mean, like in every community, you have different personality types, and you have, of course, so often many of the demo groups and the well-known demos have been made by people who are this kind of competitive type, who want to do something in front of their peers like no one did before ever. And this leads or shows also the trajectory why people with that mindset oftentimes went into game development or engine development or were affiliated with the hacker scene, because this pushing the boundaries, of course, doesn't end with demos. I mean, pushing the boundaries, we do that in games for 30 years as well. Mm-hmm. And many studios, especially in the 90s, were influenced not only that their games were cracked by demo sceners or cracker sceners at that time, But actually, they also started creating games like studios like Housemarque in Finland, or Remedy in Finland, or DICE, the engine. So Frostbite is till today is influenced by Demoscenes. Of course, there's big teams now behind all the games, but the mindset of competition, that definitely showed in the style of the community.
I think we touched on this last time you were on, but I'd like to get kind of a bit more context of where you first entered the demo scene. I mean, do you remember when you first became aware of it and what demos kind of first impressed you and made you want to get involved?
On the C64, I was like a pupil, like many others who copied the games on the schoolyard or traded them around. And so I just watched the intros there. So that was, or the cracktros. So that was amazing, but it felt like, for me, it felt like alien. It felt like, okay, there's something in front of the game, which is already like strange that games are there and I can play them. And in my environment, in my family, I mean, there was no one actually attached to computers. So in our village, I grew up in a small village, 2,000 people. There were like 2-3 kids with computers. And of course, we connected with each other. So that was like late 80s, I would say. So the real driver was 100% like the demos, which already showed like some art direction, which were effects blended into each other, which started to have a dramaturgy and not only effect after another. And that's different styles till today. Actually, there's very different. And I think you can go to a demo party and have a debate still today what people prefer more, like more music video style demo, which leads nicely into another, versus more classical style of demos where effects are presented as they are, as best as they can be, but they actually are, it's like different scenes after another, not that nicely blending into each other. I mean, you hear where I stand. I love the blending of things into each other.
Did you get into the wider culture of stuff as well, like disc magazines and music discs?
Yes, but more from the perspective of a reader, for sure. I mean, many friends were in the ASCII scene, which is very close. So NZ ASCII means you create graphic via text letters. So I mean, your audience has seen these graphics and images, but it looks like if you played like Telnet games on online games, so oftentimes that has this black and white intro that a logo is made just of out of typo. It's a little bit like calligraphic, just with fonts and letters. And so that has usually, the NZ ASCII scene was presenting their works together with music, or oftentimes with music discs, where musicians were showing their newest presentations, and then we were watching the graphics of the NZ ASCII scene, and that with the new music. So I was more passively, I mean, of course you were sharing the works, but my part was definitely more in organizing demo parties or bringing people together in our basement of my parents' house. So that's where actually we started, starting hosting small events where everybody came together from a group called first Agnostic Front and then later on Howjob.
We did mention there about demo parties, and these have happened for decades. Huge events, some of them, where demo scene and there's an enthusiast get together. There's competitions, or compos as they're nicknamed, where they present demos and music, art as well. So, I mean, what kind of memories have you got? What are some of your earliest demo scene memories? And for people that didn't attend those legendary parties back in the day, can you, any memories that stand out for you? What were they like?
Yeah, I mean, the memories which really stand out are really, I mean, on my end at least, social. Of course, there's these moments at, okay, two examples. One is a bus ride to the party 1992 in the north of Denmark, or 93. The second is a memory of the last breakpoint. But I start with the bus ride. Imagine it's the 90s, early 90s. Actually, there is no World Wide Web there. You're sitting in your small village and you have no, you have some copied discs, you have your games, you hear there's people in the next room, in the next village where you can copy maybe games, etc., drive there. And so you get to know these people, and then you hear, okay, there's, so we do this, they were from the Cracker scene, do you want to join, etc. I don't want to go there, I want to go more. So I joined like one of the groups who were cracking the games and copying the games. But then it was about this bus ride. So there is a bus ride going to the north of Denmark. And I lived in middle of Germany, right in the center, next Kassel. The wall had come down not far before that. So it was 92, right? 2 years after actually Soviet Empire collapsed. So Eastern Germany was still an alien point. And so there was this bus ride where people from seniors from Eastern Germany, from all over, actually also Southern Germany or in other countries, were actually joining and go to this to this party we heard about in the north of Denmark. And today I love to travel more than anything else, but by then my family, my father fled from Poland in Second World War and was in Denmark contained in a camp for two or three years.
Yeah.
But that was basically like their international experience, right? My parents didn't travel at all and for myself it was also, I think, the first international experiences I had at all were with the demo scene. So going with a bus to this remote place in Denmark where you get off the bus, of course, there was lots of beer by the time, which was not as cheap in Denmark as it was in Germany. So you bring all your stuff, your local culture in that sense. As 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, you travel with 40, 60 people on the bus to this remote place. And then you sit there right in the snow, in the dark. I have to say, it's the party in Denmark was always between 27th and 29th of December. So right after Christmas. You enter the halls and there's like 2,000 teenagers or 20-year-olds, maybe that's the old dudes, which were copying everything, which were screening everything. It was all illegal. And it was marvelous because it was like this this huge group of outcasts, I think, in there. So there was a gathering ground of people who maybe never or oftentimes didn't feel at home where they actually were, but found in the demo scene like a second home. And if you talk to demo sceners, this vibe, this culture of being part of something which was pretty unique in a certain time, at least for the last 20 years, from the 90s, 2000s, it was totally clear wherever you come in Europe, if there's a demo scene, you could crash on their sofa. Something you later saw maybe in the indie scene. Of course, you have other youth cultures who have this kind of strong identity, but for us it was that. So whenever you met someone later at the games conference and you found out, oh, you're from the scene too, all right, it's kind of this look, and you feel immediately connected.
I love that. I think it's really interesting when you see footage of the old demo scene parties. They have all the groups like little teams, and they've all got like a banner of their group, and I guess at some points they must have been the first time that everybody had got together. You know, they'd all be doing their individual pieces of art, and then they all come together, bring it all together in one place and kind of put, you know, faces to names.
Oh, 100%. And then you also see, of course, that demo groups have different styles. So when we started like this, this initiative to bring the demo scene into UNESCO Intangible Cultural Heritage in 2019, I first felt, and we, while doing it, learned and figured out UNESCO is like an institution of the nation states, which means to be successful with these applications, you have to tell national stories. So suddenly we had to tell, not we, but the scene in the different countries who were like working on these applications, but it's also we had to tell stories about the Polish demo scene, about the German demo scene, about the Swedish demo scene, or the Swiss. And first it felt like, no, we are an international culture. It feels like wrong, or felt wrong, to tell stories which we didn't feel they were that different. The positive thing is we then learned, actually, yes, things are different and have been different in different countries. So we are part of one community, but culturally we have also, of course, our differences. So, and also the demo groups. So HowJob, for example, was like, I mean, we had members in many countries, but the main members were first in Germany and then especially in Finland. So that was these two cultures together. So yeah, you could go into stereotypes, and some of them are true. So there was alcohol involved. There was a blunt kind of feedback involved. So people are detail oriented, and but also playful in giving respect to each other, in criticizing each other. And that doesn't work with all cultures, right? I lived for a while in the US, and I learned, okay, that let's not start with criticism to build a connection. So that works in Finland, that works in Poland, in Germany, but it doesn't work in many other places. And I had to learn to respect it as well.
It seems like a very European thing. You know, you mentioned America there. Were there any big American demo parties, or was there like a demo scene out there? Because it seemed really focused as well. Britain as well. I know there was a few groups and they had a smaller part, but that whole Scandinavian area and Germany seems to be huge. Yeah, but
UK is also very strong. Don't talk to Smash about it. No, I mean, there's
I've been to Nova.
There's definitely, I wouldn't underestimate the UK demo scene. The problem was mostly that UNESCO UK didn't sign the treaty yet, so it means that's why demo scenes in UK couldn't file for an application. So the demo scene, yes, was at core a European, or is a European scene, but we have seen us in Chile, we have seen us in Argentina, we have seen us in the US. There's also demo parties in the US nowadays even. And especially I remember in the cracker scene times, many BBS systems were actually, so there was a strong, I don't know why actually, I never looked into that, other people will know that, but there was a very strong presence of US-based bulletin board systems where people uploaded and downloaded crack games, the disc max, so the demo scene productions, but also the games. Skid Row was one of those. So they were in LA, they were on the East Coast, etc. I remember that because, again, it was also in the cracker scene, and which meant finding creative technologies that you didn't have to pay for long distance calls, means like blue boxing,
avoiding paying for calls, in other words.
Exactly. that's a short version in different ways. So yes, US were there, but the strongest part was definitely always in Europe, and the reason mostly is home computers. The reason is in the US, consoles were way, way more proliferated, way more the way how people got into games. So like Nintendo, NES, etc., all these beautiful consoles. And in Europe, I think mostly people got into games, or at least for a large part, or larger, way larger part, via home computers. Because, yeah, they could copy and crack, etc. Console cracking, of course, was happening as well, but that was a much smaller part compared to PC games cracking, or home computers.
I know, and I've looked at kind of the history of kind of the demo scene and these parties, and it's still something that happens today. We had a massive demo party revision that happened over the Easter weekend, so they're still going strong. And there are often categories that the demos are placed in. For example, I know that demos that fit into 40 kilobytes is still a really common category, and they're often broken down into systems as well. I mean, what were kind of some of the categories you remember from back then? And also I'm wondering, you mentioned it was big on the Commodore 64 and the Amiga. How did that change when like the PC came along? You know, was the PC demo scene like a category in itself?
It was in the beginning. I mean, first it was really the platforms. I mean, that's a complete genealogy, or what's a better thing? Yeah, so it's a complete history of how competitions evolved over time. But first, it definitely was the system, because until today, I mean, you have C64 competitions, you have Amiga competitions, and you might have even Amiga competitions for the classical OCS, for the Amiga 500, and then for the 1200 based competitions, which had a better graphics chip, so people could do more for it. And depending on the demo party, so I'm part of a team of Evoke demo party that has been going on for 25 editions now, I think. And that was early on already a PC demo party. So the, from your perspective, retro-focused platforms like C64 and Amiga, for us, we never left them. So the demo scene just continued doing things until it was retro. But so that was more a retro category. And then if there were enough submissions in a category, so it always depends on who's coming to a party, who is submitting for the category. And if you see that many, many people submit for a certain category, let's say C64 or Amiga or pixel graphics, then it might happen that people think, or organizers think, okay, let's do next year two competitions and add a twist. Maybe it's about pixel graphics, but only with dogs. I don't know. This is like a weird category. But, and what happened historically, so first there was C64 and Amiga, and then different subcategories in that, but after the PC came, the problem was, how do you compare? Because you could always put a better graphics card in, like they were developed, and you could always put a better processor in. I mean, the C64 stayed the same till today in that sense. So if you want to compare, if you want to compete, what can someone do with that system? Now it was uncomparable. So, because, yeah, it's a new graphics card, right? So is it really still good what they are doing there? And that's when actually the self-limitation happened. Mm-hmm. So what the disk did with the boot block, that it didn't have much size to put an intro in front of the correct game, that limit people put on themselves, actually, and said, okay, we create a category where only 64 kilobyte were allowed, were allowed in the competition, which means it's like the software, so the whole video, the graphics, the effects, the music, the art direction, how the camera flows through a scene, maybe the pixel graphics, or whatever is in that demo is then created out of 64 kilobytes, or later on, so 64 was like the major category, like in the mid-90s till, or late-90s till mid-2000s. I don't know anymore. I should have looked it up when 4K competitions came up.
Which that's was crazy. Big this year, yeah. It's
like 4 kilobyte. That's as many letters you can put on a page in that sense. Of course, it's like digital code. It's not, I mean, it's compressed, and people play around with all kinds of ways how you can maximize what's in this 4,000 letters or kilobytes. But yeah, that's when the self-limitation started. And again, people are competing in that creatively till today.
I was wondering as well about some of the crazier categories as well. So they have the wild category, of course, which... you know, anything could get entered in. I've seen a left hand drawing one, which was non-dominant hands, and everyone had to draw, and competitions for that. What are some of the kind of maddest things you've seen at demo parties happening?
I think Fuzzle from Howdrop, he worked at Siemens Nixdorf for a few years, and so he had access to ATMs, so cash machines, and so, which is basically Windows computers. So they created like a submission for a Wild Compo where a Howdrop demo was running on a cash machine, on an ATM. So at the end of a demo, it was dispensing money. And so, I mean, that's also the playful attitude, right? There's always like, there's always this, yes, we put these categories on ourselves. I mean, the wild category, again, that can be anything. In that sense, people did sang a song for a birthday party, actually on, so Rob is Jarig, I think that started like as a meme on demo parties, which is sung till today. There's like, it was a super clumsy small little intro, but people started singing to it, and that became a meme, and then its own thing, of course. And you have that a lot if you go to a demo party, and that can be sometimes the arcane, a little bit difficult part. If you're first time on something, many of the references you don't understand, of course, because they're referring to something which happened at another demo party, maybe
some in joke
10
yeah.
years ago. Yeah, yeah, that can happen.
Well, you mentioned then that the demo scene is UNESCO recognized, and for people unfamiliar with that, that's the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, who aim to, they do a lot, but promote, you know, arts and sciences and culture. So where did the idea come from to get the demo scene recognized by them, and what was their initial reaction like then? I mean, were they even familiar with what it was? Did it take some explaining? Can they talk us through what happened there?
Oh, it did. It took a lot of explaining, because where did it come from? I think it was a drinks idea with Andreas Lange from Computerspiele Museum.
Like all the best ideas.
So that was definitely, and then, I mean, we have like the logical arguments, how we convinced people in the scene, why we want to do it, etc. So, I don't know, more visibility for the scene, that new people actually enter the scene, new coders, new graphicians, etc. Because, of course, there is a risk that the demo scene might not die out, but that, I mean, people get older, people die, the knowledge gets lost. So there is a risk on that end. So to get new blood into the scene, or help organizers managing risk if they have to rent a place, there's of course a high risk financially if you rent one of the bigger halls for 500,000 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 people, because everything in the scene is volunteer run, and from the beginning whatever is done for the scene has to be basically for free, because also the demo sceners give their stuff away for free. But actually, the argument which convinced people the most was because we can. So there was this kind of, yeah, no one hacked UNESCO. I mean, at least in the mindset of, so let's do this playful thing. Can we fit into these categories they put up actually for traditional culture? And I'm just looking here on the screen. So on our first, like the first application which was filed was in Finland and Germany almost at the same time. In 2019 we started the thing, but then 2020 it became, during the pandemic, of course, also a major outlet for personal energy, because I work on events and on artistic stuff, and both didn't work at all. So this was also a great outlet of work, but of energy, and find a place to do something positive. And so just one of these points they had on their application. So type of immaterial cultural heritage. Section A, verbally passed on traditions and expressions. Of course, usually it would be oral culture, right?
Yeah.
We can fit into that. We have our own idiom with specialized terminology. We have tech, anyhow. Then section B, performing arts. Composition, we argued, yeah, we have composition, it's performance, it's live programming, it's public presentations, it's animations, we fit into that. Section C, social tradition, seasonal celebration and ritual. Yep,
definitely got that, yeah.
So demo parties, competitions, visitor voting and prize ceremonies, we do that. Section, so there's five, I mean, F is L, so two more. Knowledge and customs related to nature or the universe. And that's where, of course, we got a little more philosophical in that sense. It's about digitalized living environment. It's about cyberspace, virtual reality. But then when the pandemic actually happened, we realized, so that was the first draft. But during the pandemic, we also realized, no, actually, digital culture is still, we need to meet each other. We need to come together. Yes, of course, we are online. And for us, it's a big, big part of it. But in the end, without coming together, without a community, without convening, doesn't work. So it's really important. And lastly, section E, traditional craftsmanship. I mean, of course, that's about the skills. It's about coding, composition, animation, the do-it-yourself attitude, etc., etc. So we played with these categories, but I still love this knowledge about the nature or the universe. But in the end, I mean, there's so many nerds in the scene who love, of course, tech, who love science, etc., who love to build models about how things work, physics or whatnot. And so, yeah, to answer your question, it's like an intellectual game and a play at the same time. But then, of course, as we talk about also like the retro scene, it's also about digital culture as something to be taken seriously. This is not just something which goes away. That's the places where we live in. And as I work also in games for 15 years or game conferences, this UNESCO project is about the scene, and that's the important bit. But of course, games is so much more. We live and breathe within games, or it's not more, but it's also a space where we live and breathe in. And it's definitely, it has, I mean, someone has to think about that if they want to do their own application. But we wanted to open doors, at least, that UNESCO first time has to think about, digital created culture is culture.
Since getting recognized by UNESCO, have you noticed like a lot more acceptance of the demo scene by the kind of wider art world and a lot more interest from press?
It comes and goes in waves. I mean, from press, definitely it has now, and press, politicians, if you want to go to your local city, and it is, again, if you want to run a party. So demo sceners had already success, for example, in Switzerland, actually running new demo parties with support of a local canton, for example, and get a support on that.
I guess they accept it more as well.
Exactly.
You kind of explain, you know, it's recognized by UNESCO, and they go, you can use our hall.
Exactly. Yeah. And many demo scenes actually reached also out and simply said, yeah, thanks for explaining my mom that what I actually did, or explaining that it is something of value. And so this is something I underestimated when we started the initiative, how much it is also about being seen as, and that's like the paradox thing. In the scene, actually, you want to be a subculture, and that was also the critical part. When people heard about this initiative, will it change the scene? Will it make, is there a risk of sellout? Mike, you might or like has been in this discussion in the hip-hop scene and the graffiti scene or other parts. The demo scene, I think so far, there was no sellout, that the L'Oreal's and others came and entered the space with gazillions of money. It's more really being recognized, being a little more supported in that sense, if it's about official institutions. And of course, definitely also new singers. We had to navigate this fine line of representing the culture, but not wanting to change the culture.
Yeah.
And that is, of course, in today's online debates about identity and political perspective, not that easy. And not that I don't have a position on that, to how to be innovative, how to involve more people, better representation, etc. But for UNESCO, it was first important to represent a culture as it is, not to make something up for something else. And I asked them in the beginning, because I grew up on the countryside, as I mentioned. So for us, like Schützenfest, it's like, how to translate that? It's like wine fest, but with beer, and people yeah. get drunk for 3 days in the same hall and then shoot at a target. And whoever hits the target is king for a year and has to pay a lot. I mean, this is, but it has, of course, a lot of high status in the community. And that's mostly historically just dudes allowed in these, and they only to be part of the associations. And so I was like asking them, so is this a problem or not? I mean, because, and then they said, no, represent it as it is, but also write where maybe the challenges are. And so in the first application, we also, of course, we said, yeah, this is like, let's say 80-85% of the demo scene has been historically dudes. Actually, the scenes picked up over the last three, 4 or 5 years, the discussion also internally. And we don't take, absolutely, I wouldn't take any credit for it. But it happened at the same time that debates of representation also started in the scene. Because, I mean, yeah, it happens in general culture, so why not there?
In terms of maybe someone that's interested in the demo scene and, you know, they don't really know what goes into creating a demo. I know, like, back in the day, I assumed that most Amiga demos were made in assembly, 68K assembly, often with tools like Deluxe Paint and Pro Tracker, that kind of thing. I mean, how's that kind of evolved then? What are generally demos created in today? Has that evolved over the last, like, two or three decades?
So first, people started creating their own demo tools for their own demos. I mean, people love to do it all handcrafted, but then in one point in time, you realize also, okay, if we do this part over and over and over again, maybe let's write a tool for us, ourselves, for better direction, for better pacing, for better, output. And I would say in the last 10 years, then more and more demo scenes started releasing their tools and make them public. It doesn't mean it's like a full-blown engine with full documentation and a 500 people developer relations team behind it explaining you how you should use it. But the tools are now open there. So Cables, for example, is like a tool which is very much like inspired by the visual programming scene for beautiful imagery done by Pandur and many others. So the demo group still, or the company Framefield, they released like the tool called Tool. And that's really also a beautiful example. It's Tool with three O's, Berlin-based company. That's really beautiful to play around with. So if someone wants not to go right away into shader programming, that's like the programming of these effects in visual graphics, but wants to play with tools, this would be two places to start. But then there's also like YouTube channels from who give you at least a few tools at the hands by PS, for example, in Portugal, who has like a video starting block where starting point where you can learn like doing your first demo effects. Another part where to start as well is the shader toy community. That's like an online tool. It's like a visual coder, like you would learn CSS programming or any kind of web-based programming in a browser. And shadertoy.com, that's also a great tool because all the effects are there. Like in a library, you can just see the text and what at the same time what comes out of it, and then play around with it, edit it, and learn from that. So that would be two places maybe to start. But the most motivating place to start is, of course, to go to a demo party, because without a community, it's the big part of motivation for demo sceners until today is to show a demo at a demo party. And this means a demo party means it is like a 16 meter or 25 meter diagonal, big screen, super big sound set, people for 3 days in the same hall, which might be tired at the end and then see these amazing visuals, which means if you're tired, they're even more impressive. And get the feedback from your peers afterwards, or from people who have also who are just also friends and inspired by this. It is from the beginning, everybody who goes to a demo party gets a vote, one vote for each demo category. Means if you enter a demo party, you get really like at the beginning, you got a paper. Which had like a key code, and nowadays you get still a key code, but it's longer. You enter it into a browser, and then you can vote on all, on the graphics competition, the different music competitions, the demo compo on Amiga and PC, and in different categories. So 64 kilobyte, 4 kilobyte, etc. Long story short, it is super democratic. So everybody who is a visitor of a demo party has a vote in all the categories. So there's no juries. It's only the community who from the beginning decided. And this, of course, is also even more motivating because then, you know, you convinced all these people around you with your production. Or, of course, if you just start, then you get the recognition, let's say, maybe in a first time at a demo party competition. So we have that Evoke for the newcomer compo, which always regards like two or three new sceners actually and welcome them to the scene.
I'm pleased to hear that's a thing as well, because there's one thing, as someone who's a bit of an outsider to it all, I mean, I used to, you know, enjoy demos back in the 90s, and I'd read, you know, disc mags like Grapevine, and although I didn't actually get involved in any demo groups or go to any parties. One thing I always saw back then, it seemed like there was a kind of a bit of elitism in the scene in some ways. For example, you mentioned about using tools. I remember there was like a demo creator tool that one of the Amiga magazines gave away. And I read that if you use that, you were a lamer. They'd call people that use like these beginner friendly tools. I wonder now that we're all kind of grown up, has that changed? But then I also saw that there has been some people kind of reacting quite strongly against new demo groups using AI, for example, in some of their productions. I mean, what's kind of your thoughts on that?
Ooh. Yeah, that's too different. Interesting. It sounds, and I thought so as well, it sounds like it's two similar topics, but I think it's in that sense different. First, on the tools, yes, of course. And the elitist part of the demo scene, that's actually, I mean, the challenging part about if you're 100% competitive, then there's always the risk that you look down on people who are not as good as you are. I can only speak for myself. I mean, I'm a community person. I run conferences. I bring people together. So that part, I respected whatever the demo groups who were a little more elitist put out, because, of course, they did great stuff. But on a personal level, of course, I love more if people do great stuff and then are still decent, because you can connect with them. Because this is like also, if I talk to game creators, I mean, that's the high art, right? To kick ass and be a fantastic human at the same time to other people and be welcoming and including. And that has always been part of both, has been part of the scene, I have to say. So, yes, but that kind of elitist attitude, I think that held many people back actually to contribute. And I've never discussed this actually with anyone, but I would maybe, yeah, maybe that was also part by why it never became a mass phenomenon, aside of the challenges to learn what is needed. But maybe, I mean, the indie scene or game development became so proliferant, so a cultural phenomenon nowadays, I think. Yeah, maybe that was a challenge. So AI is a really hot topic in that sense that you would assume it's like, again, you can play with it, we can create. So there's like two different camps right now. Of course, you can play around, you can create own categories for it and own competitions, and you could do that. The other camp is everything in the scene was always about self-empowerment or making something happen what you do yourself. So the C64, it turned on, and then it had just this blinking cursor, this light blue on dark blue, and it asks you to do something with it. And this kind of mindset of doing everything, so having 100% control, knowledge, skill, again, the craftsmanship, you could say, digital craftsmanship, if you use AI, is it then still the same, or what happens then with it? And it starts already, of course, if you use autocomplete or copilot, and to just do that small part, there's a really, I would say, visceral, strong debate right now on this, and I would dedicate a full episode for that.
I say, Dan, John, I'm sure. Yeah.
I was like, Dan, you've opened Pandora's box.
It's a hot topic right now, though, isn't it?
Of course, at games conferences as well. But it's not 100% about the culture and the identity of it. For us, it's also in the demo scene really a question: what happens to our identity, to our culture, This is what people did, and how do you compare? How do you play with it, etc.? If the black box, and that's the thing, the black box of AI gets into it, of course, to get to a result, AI is amazing. I mean, there's no question about it. But what happens to the creators in relation to each other? That it's an open question.
I was wondering then, what's kind of plan next for the UNESCO bit, like any other places going for it? Is it growing as an initiative? And what are you up to next?
Actually, now seven countries accepted the UNESCO, accepted the demo scene as intangible cultural heritage. And that's the thing. It's not like Stonehenge or Machu Picchu about the physical buildings. It's, or the residuals. Or, yeah, it's really about the living, breathing culture. So the way how people relate to each other, how competition, the community, the democracy, etc. So all that described. So we have seven countries now, and the last two, Sweden and France, were just actually announced just this month. So it was super new. So we have Finland started in 2020, then 21 Germany, 21 also Poland, then the Netherlands in 23, and the Switzerland in 23, and now Sweden and France in 25. So what's next on that end? I mean, the final aim is to combine. Our challenge is we need now one leading country, which then leads the international application. That's not going into detail here because that's like UNESCO intent. So it's UNESCO processes. But the long story short is each country more gives a higher probability that a culture is accepted as international intangible heritage. And right now we are looking at, we thought Finland would lead this application, but Finland is not, the sauna is not yet accepted. So that's difficult. So we have to
can't believe that. Yeah,
it's shocking.
In France and Sweden, it's in debate. So we are looking like, because yeah, it's like a technical thing, but we want to do next international application to make it also tangible for other countries like in UK or Hungary or many other places.
I think that's really important. I mean, obviously, it has been a huge part of digital culture. And the fact that you've come this far with it, Tobias, best of luck with the next step. I think it's absolutely worthwhile. And it's been great catching up with you as well. And thank you for coming on and being our guest and doing some reminiscing with us about the old days too. That's been fun to hear. And hopefully we'll see you at a demo party soon.
Oh, yes. Evoke August 2025, the weekend before Gamescom. If you're coming to Gamescom, consider coming to Evoke. It's right the weekend before.
It's a pilgrimage. We definitely need to make that.
And thanks for having me. I mean, the time flew by quickly.